Stay tuned to acure.org for the latest updates on the world's only conference dedicated to cardiac unloading and heart recovery. acure.org.
You're listening to Heart Sounds, TCTMD's award-winning podcast hosted by Shelley Wood.
Hello and welcome to the Heart Sounds podcast for March 2024. I am your host, Shelley Wood, managing editor at TCTMD. I have said this in the past, I think, but I love daylight savings, and those of you in places where time also springs forward, I'm guessing, feel the same. I have been working in cardiology long enough that I also think of daylight savings time as ACC conference time. They have certainly landed on the same weekend in the past. This year we have a few weeks to adjust, but by the time this podcast airs, ACC 2024 will be just 1 week away. I hope to see some of you in Atlanta. If you are a regular listener to Heart Sounds, you know that I occasionally take a break from summarizing top cardiology news to chat with physicians who also actively practice in the arts. I have spoken with writers and poets, musicians and artists, and my guest this month falls into that last category. All of you, I'm guessing, know C. Michael Gibson of the Brigham and Women's Hospital as an interventional cardiologist, a clinical trialist, and the CEO of the combined nonprofit BAME and Perfuse Research Institutes at Harvard. Many, but perhaps not all of you, know that he is also a visual artist. Here is my conversation with Mike Gibson. Thank you so much, Mike, for joining me on the Heart Sounds podcast. We do this occasionally where we talk about not cardiology, but art. This is something you've been practicing for quite a bit of time, and I'd love to know, when did you get your start? When did you first pick up a paintbrush, or when did you start drawing?
Well, my mother was a painter. She's died now, but was a painter. I grew up with the smell of turpentine in the house, and she painted, and, you know, obviously as a curious child, I would wanted to kind of join in. I wasn't a very good painter. So she said, you know, here's something simple. Just paint some clouds. You know, they're white and here's some blue and just kind of mix them up. And, you know, taught me about mixing and things like that. And she said something to me, which I think really resonated throughout the rest of my life, which is, you know, once you paint a cloud, you'll never look at a cloud the same way again. And I do think, you know, when you are a visual artist, it makes you a better visual athlete. And you do begin to see things that other people might not necessarily see. If you fast forward decades later, I began to paint angiograms. And I know that sounds crazy, but, you know, as being a part of a visual athlete, I did it. And there's always this, you know, the dye's going down the artery, but, you know, it's got to go somewhere. And there's always this cloud, literally a cloud of dye down the heart muscle. And I said, you know, we got to start analyzing this cloud of dye down there. That's got to mean something. And turns out, you know, the information sat in a drawer for a while. And I said, hey, you know, the abstracts are coming up. Maybe we should look at that cloud stuff. And, you know, we did, my right-hand person, Sabina Murphy, the statistician, started doing some tables and showed me the first one where it showed that, you know, normal blood flow into the muscle, to me, grade 3 perfusion into the myocardium had the best outcomes. And the shocking thing was that even if he had a perfectly open artery, you know, artery looks great, ass blood flow, everyone's giving each other a high five at the end of the case. If he ran into a brick wall at the end of the artery into the muscle and there was no cloud of dye there, or if the cloud of dye stained the heart muscle, that had as bad of a mortality as if you never got the artery open. And I wrote it up within an hour, sent it to Braunwald. He wrote back to me within an hour or two. I revised it and we got it out the same day to circulation. It's accepted with very few, if any, revisions. And it was the kind of lead article in the inaugural edition in 2000. So I think the story is, being a really good visual athlete helps you if you are a scientist, because, you know, so much sciencey studies is done with AI and big data and, you know, all of that. I think it's what's been lost, and what I try and coach young people on, is being an observer, collecting data. For me, my career was really predicated on collecting data, and particularly visual imaging data, and inventing a couple of things based on that. So, yeah.
Well, you've really managed to tie this into cardiology really quickly, and I knew we'd get here in this conversation, but I love the idea of this being an athletic endeavor, because I do think that art in itself, you mentioned before we started recording that it's a bit woo-woo to some people, but in fact, it is a practice. It isn't just something that happens organically, in many cases. It's something that people need to work at. And you have been, since those days when you first were painting clouds, you've obviously become quite skilled. So it sounds as if you were self-taught, or did you ever study art?
Well, certainly studied art history at University of Chicago. I was in a woo-woo program called the ASHM program, Arts and Sciences, basic to human biology and medicine. And it really was not your traditional pre-med program. I spent a year reading Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics from the original Greek, and, you know, working with Leon Kass, who was special advisor to President Reagan, in a small group of eight, and, you know, courses like that, and of course multiple art history classes. And so studied art history, which I think is very important, but also studied a little bit, not a lot, a little bit over at the museum here in Boston. They have courses, but mostly self-taught. But it is work. I mean,
you have to practice.
It is a practice. And there's two elements of it. There is the technical part, which is work. And, you know, people say, oh, that's a great painting. I can't believe you can paint like Rembrandt. Well, no, that's actually pretty, you know, technically, okay, maybe challenging, but it's pretty easy, you know. I mean, the technical aspects of art really recapitulate the development of art as a whole. You're not very good at perspective, and then, you know, as a child, and then you get better at perspective. And frankly, we think that the camera obscura was used by some early artists, even Vermeer. He made those leaps because he was using technology, like a camera obscura was a projector that he would trace from and actually get the colors right too. There's a great, great movie called Tim's Vermeer, where it took him 4 years to paint the Vermeer, but he used a camera obscura to replicate the tones and everything exactly in a studio. So then you begin to get perspective right, and then you really craft your art, and that's work. But that's not art. That is not art. You want to be so good technically that you're not even thinking about it. When you're not even thinking about it, that's when real art occurs. And, you know, that's the woo-woo part of, like, it's not really, frankly, coming from me. I think when you shut down your conscious aspect of the technical aspect, you allow your mind to kind of engage with non-local intelligence. I'm going to say it, something outside of yourself.
Yeah.
Where you are just a receiver. It's almost like I have Wi-Fi turned on, and I'm just a recipient for this stuff coming through, and I'm able to paint it or get it out there technically without thought. So you have to get to a without thought point. And I bet for you in your writing, I bet it's something similar, perhaps.
Yes, I was thinking about that, because my dad, who's a very creative person, really early on spoke to me about allowing the subconscious to do its work. And it's true that when your mind is switched on, you can only focus really on the doing of things. And it's when you are able to reduce the amount of signals coming in that actually you become receptive to something that you wouldn't have otherwise thought was there. So that totally resonates with me. And the difficulty with that, I find, and I'd love to hear what you have to say about it, is making time for it, making time to switch off all of the other data input that we have with very rewarding careers. I mean, this is what you're best known for in our audience of cardiologists. How do you make time, and have you always made time, to work on your art, the technical as well as the clearing the slate for the woo-woo? How do you make time for that?
Yeah, I think, you know, when I was young and trying to get ahead in my 30s, I didn't make time until my father got critically ill. And, well, he had a meningioma, a benign tumor in a malignant location, and had surgery at the Brigham the day after Christmas when I was chief resident. And had a two-month hospitalization in the ICU. And my mother was here, and she's the painter. And of course, we had to spend our time together, began painting. It was a very traumatic period in my life, with my father dying, my mom drank, and I would have to go get her out of the bar every day at Longwood and bring her home, and we'd paint. After my father died, you know, my marriage fell apart and I was living across from a women's shelter with two boys. So it was a traumatic period in my life. And I do think trauma somehow does, I don't know how, but does open you up somehow to more creative influences in some way. And it was really after, and I even got sick. I had chicken pox of the lung and had ARDS. I was on experimental drugs. So, you know, I lost everything. My house, nearly lost my life, my father, everything. And I do think, you know, when you lose everything, that kind of trauma does set the foundation for a very, something very strong to build upon. You know, I would look around and I would really see, after losing everything, I'd really see beauty in everything. And at that point, I was more of a photographer at that point, a serious photographer, you know, with a medium format camera, you know, got my own dark room and sold my work and, you know, was a very good photographer. But then I began to pull in more and more color through painting. But I do think somehow trauma does influence our creative choices and careers.
I think that's so true. And I sometimes lament that. Like, I think about some of my most creative periods have been when I have been desperately sad. And yet you want to tap that same emotion without going through trauma. If that's where you got your start, how have you then found ways to also seek out that emotional solace in times of joy or times of just regular days? How do you make time emotionally for that?
You know, it's, people may not realize this about me. I think they think I'm an extrovert. I'm actually very, very much an introvert. And, you know, when I walk through a convention center or something, I'm absorbing all of that energy around me and it's flowing through me. And it really, really is painful for me, you know, as someone who's very receptive emotionally. And I need time to kind of go back to my room and not be around people. And so I do view it as a time where I'm not engaged with people. The phone is off. You know, there's no one can call me. It's a quiet time. It's nowadays, I got thrown out of the first floor because everything was kind of bleeding over into the rest of the house, you know. So now I'm up on the third floor of the house. And, you know, it's my kind of, it's not a cave, it's my man third floor. And, okay. It's very, very comfortable. Great couches. Everyone can sit on if they want to come hang out. But I really do paint mostly alone. But it is a place where I get into that space of really quiet, no contact from anyone. I do play music, which I find helpful for me. But it's hard for me. And I know it's hard for a lot of people to shut it off. But I do manage to shut it off. And it's a challenge because, you know, you're running and you don't want to stop running, but you got to force yourself. You got to force yourself to stop running. And I find it's good to have certain times that you decide you're going to dedicate that, you know, like at night or, you know, on weekends. Obviously, I paint a lot on weekends.
Yeah.
So you have to, you know, you can't find the time. You have to make the time, as you said, and I know as a writer, I'm sure you have to make the time, which is different than finding time. You're never going to find it.
If you just find the time, it somehow becomes a little bit more scrambled. I think that, yeah, to go back to where we were saying, where people try to get their minds around how artistic practice happens, you do have to schedule it. And for me, I have to do it very early in the morning before all the stimuli come in from other things. Right. I do think that takes a little bit of the mystery out of it. It's not sort of divine inspiration strikes and you run to your canvas or your notebook. You really have to make the time and make it a practice. And I can very much see that in everything you're saying. I do like to ask on these conversations because I think people tend to think of themselves as creative or uncreative. And they look at someone like you who's doing these incredible paintings alongside a very impressive career. And they think, oh, well, I don't have that. I couldn't do that. But I personally have come around to the thinking that actually anyone can do it. And, you know, I have a theory on this, but I'd like to ask you, what do you think is the value for scientists, cardiologists, anyone really, to make time for some sort of creative practice? Is there a benefit that's intrinsic to that? Does it feed their professional worlds? Does it do both? Thoughts?
Both, you know, my sons are both scientists, and we argue a bit about this. They're strict reductionist, and I'm an anti-reductionist. And I keep arguing examples, you know, say of Einstein. Well, Einstein's theory were an act of creation. These were thought experiments, and you know, so it was not something this fact led to this fact led to this fact. No, it was a complete departure from any kind of line of inquiry in the past. And these transitions in science are actually creative acts. And on the other hand, when you look at great scientists, look at Da Vinci. He actually was an amazing artist, and he was so good at tracing the vortices of blood flow coming out of the aorta. He discovered that what's causing the valves to kind of collapse is the shape of that aortic annulus, which creates those turbulent blood flows that close the valve. And you know, now years later, hundreds of years later, like, oh, wow, that's why we have an aortic annulus. It's causing the valve collapse. And he described that a few hundred years ago. So I do think being a careful observer, certainly when we used to do true observational research, does make you a better scientist. And I think science can make you a better artist. Certainly Vermeer and others, when they learned about perspective, it was through optics. It was like they were projecting the scene onto their canvas. So it is bidirectional. And but I still think, I know this is going to rub people the wrong way. I still think the creative part is more important. Anyone can say, here's fact, here's the next factoid. I do think the leaps come from the creative side. And you know, again, I think there's a little bit of woo-woo to it where you do plug into something bigger than yourself.
I love it. I would like to know, as a final question, what you're painting right now. We can't see it, but maybe you can describe it to us.
What I'm working on right now is there's a heart transplant society that focuses on helping patients get their meds paid for that they can't afford or get transportation to the hospital, things like that. And it's a nonprofit. So I've been charged with creating some paintings for them that they will auction off.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on the Heart Sounds podcast. Honestly, I could talk to you an hour about this stuff because I find it personally really inspiring. So it's great to get some insight into it. And of course, I'll be seeing you at ACC in just a couple of weeks. You've got a big late breaker with the other side of your brain. You're presenting AGIS-2 there. So we'll be covering that on TCTMD, of course. And you'll be asked some different questions by TCTMD at that point, I'm sure.
I bet. Well, such a big fan of yours. Keep writing, keep creating. Thanks for talking to me.
Really appreciate it. Have a great day.
Sure.
That is all I've got for you for Heart Sounds this month. I hope you managed to catch some of our print coverage of both the CRT meeting in Washington and the THT meeting in Boston by reporters Laura McEwen and Michael O'Riordan. You will also want to tune into the March edition of Rock's Heart Radio, which aired mid-month. Host Roxana Moran spoke with ACC Program Chair Douglas Drachman of Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital about what to expect at the ACC meeting next week. As I said, I will be in Atlanta with the rest of the TCTMD journalists, as well as our senior clinical editor, Mamas Mamas, so be sure to reach out if you have news tips or feedback. And for now, thank you for tuning in to Heart Sounds.
Do you love listening to Heart Sounds? Check out all new original content from TCTMD featuring Talking Points with Dr. C. Michael Gibson and Rock's Heart Radio with Dr. Roxana Moran. All new episodes are available on Google Play, iTunes, Spotify, and SoundCloud.